You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a guest makes the case for a plan from the U.S. Air Force that could bring F-35 fighter jets to a base in Madison. First, swamps, marshes, peatlands, those are some of the main types of wetlands found in Wisconsin. And a bill that recently passed the state legislature would take additional steps to both create new wetlands and better mitigate negative effects on existing ones. It's waiting for a signature from Governor Evers. Republican State Senator Van Wongard is co-author of the bill with Republican State Representative Ron Tussler. Senator Wongard represents the 21st State Senate District that includes parts of Racine and Kenosha counties. We talked with him earlier today. Senator Wongard, welcome back.
I really appreciate you guys bringing a light to this issue we have.
Can you talk about, before we get into the details of the legislation, can you talk about the importance of wetlands in especially urban and small-town parts of Wisconsin?
Well, you know, I think probably the biggest thing that we really have overlooked is when we start doing the economic growth and we start looking at the issues that we can have with flooding and where water goes, we don't realize how important it is to continue to have those wetlands available to mediate those flooding conditions. I mean, that makes such a huge, huge difference. And, of course, last year we worked on the drainage ditches and working with management districts for water, and I didn't realize how much water really was going to affect us. I never thought it was going to be that big of a bill, but it took us a little over 2.5 years, almost 3 years, to get it done, and 100 and some meetings, but we did. So wetlands are so important to our environment, to the species that we have there, but it's so important that we have it for just being able to maintain the water runoff. It's huge.
And let's talk about now what is in the bill. There's a couple key elements of it, as described by the Legislative Reference Bureau. It says the bill would offer incentives for creating wetlands where we need them. How does that work?
Well, in the past, they've bought credits, and you have wetland credits. So if I was going to do some economic development, say, here in our area, and I was going to build on, let's say, an acre of wetland here, I would have to buy credits so that I had at least 1.2 acres someplace else. Well, those credits generally are not in the area where you're actually doing the development. They could be up in the northern part of the state. So once we buy those credits kind of stay in this bank, and it takes forever to be able to release the funding from those banks. So consequently, I think we started those wetland banks 6 or 7 years ago, and they haven't developed one wetland yet using those banks because it just becomes so difficult for developers to be able to come in and do it because of the cost and everything up front and the length of time before they get their payback. So this will pretty much mitigate that in that it would allow those developers to develop wetland banks that are closer to the area that's being mediated, and it would be within that watershed, and they would be able to have draws on the dollars that are in that are being set aside to develop that wetland. Those dollars would be able to be drawn on earlier in the process, so it helps that developer that's developing the wetland bank to be able to actually start working on developing the wetland area that they're trying to replenish.
And
does that make sense?
If I have this right, if, say, I'm developing in Racine, say, or the outskirts of Racine, and I'm developing on a wetland, I have to mitigate by doing a new one, your legislation makes it so that replacement wetland would be closer, would be in the same watershed, right?
Correct. And if for some reason there wasn't someplace that was available that was suitable for a wetland development in that, we call them HUCs, or they're actually known as HUCs, which is developed by or created by the U.S. Geological Survey. If it's within that HUC and we don't have room to be able to do it there for some reason, whatever that might be, then you can go to the next area that's on the outside or closest to where that area is. So we start to expand the area where you could choose to redo a wetland. So we're keeping it as close to the area that we've taken it away as humanly possible.
Talking to Wisconsin State Senator Van Wongert about legislation on wetlands in Wisconsin and how we mitigate it when we develop over wetlands here in the state. So one concern might be, okay, if I have to create this new wetland in the same area, well, that's really narrowing things down. It could slow down the process of mediation. Is that going to happen?
Well, actually, you know, I think if we really have a plan in place and a process in place where we could have areas that would be perfect to be developed into a wetland area in different regions or in the different watersheds, then I think we could probably draw on some developers to actually do the wetland banks. So, in other words, they would do that. They would set aside an area that they're going to put into the bank as an investment, and then as developers wanted to develop, they could choose to buy those credits or put those dollars in that local land bank. And so now it's going to help the local economy, but we're also going to have an area that's going to be developed that's going to help us keep those wetlands close and develop them properly. We'll have oversight to make sure that they're meeting those benchmarks, that we're not just, you know, throwing money someplace and it's not developing the way it should. So there's all those things are built into this process also, too, for oversight. So I think right now I want to say there's 15 or 16 wetlands we have in the state. And most of those are up north. So I think this is going to help with the process of having things closer to southeastern Wisconsin, as well as, you know, the areas that we have more of an urban build out.
I've talked to some wetlands experts in the state who say, I'm paraphrasing heavily here, Mother Nature's better at making wetlands than people are. Do you have anything is in this legislation and elsewhere to protect current wetlands that might do a better job of being wetlands than the stuff we might make?
Well, I think, number one, we want to maintain our wetlands so that we utilize those areas and continue to help them remain in conservancy. I mean, we do that here. As an example, the Caledonia Conservancy, they have been phenomenal with what they've done to help maintain our trails and the Pike River. And, I mean, all those areas that are important to us for, you know, the nature purposes and also helping to reduce the flooding also. But the development of wetlands, you're right. The areas that those wetlands have been created that are more susceptible to being maintained there. What's changed a lot of that is some of the economic development that's happened, you know, decades ago, because they weren't looking at, I think, how that was going to affect people downrange. And I think we learned that over that 2.5-year process when we were dealing with the drainage commissions. I mean, it was a huge issue that really hadn't been looked at unless it bothers somebody. If it makes an effect on somebody, or has an effect on somebody, then all of a sudden you have an interest because it's potentially got a negative effect when all of a sudden you're getting somebody else's water. So I think it's important for us to value what we have, maintain whatever we have, and if there's any way that we can continue to keep those wetlands and keep them viable, I mean, that should be our goal. But sometimes, you know, you've got to look at both sides of the coin here, too, that if we have something that is going to be an economic development, an example would be, you know, with what's happening with Foxconn. I know they have taken several acres that were in wetland that they'll be building on, and they're going to be building on, I think it's 2 or 3 times what they take. So the requirement is 1.2 acres for every acre that you take. Well, they've doubled it. They're going to do at least 2 acres for every acre that they have to use. And the idea is that they're engineering around that. They want to keep those wetlands in place, too, as much as possible, because it helps them to deal with their water issues, too. So I think people are being more alerted to what those areas of wetlands actually do, as opposed to people saying, why do we allow that to happen? We should do something with that. You know, we should, you know, allow people to build so that we don't have any more of those wetlands. Well, that's not a good thing. I mean, for us to have a good wetland that is developed, the habitat, the birds, the animals, give them an area that they can have sanctuary also. I mean, we have to really, really be thinking about what we're doing as we're doing this. And this is one of the good things about this bill is that there is support from environmental groups because they see the value, too, to just mitigate a wetland that's up north that was they're going to put in between where two roads came together and it was kind of stranded, so we'll make that a wetland. I mean, that doesn't make sense either. So this is going to help us with the region where we're actually doing the economic development. So the people that live there are going to be watching to see what's developed, and there's going to be more oversight locally, which I think is just going to be a really good thing, and I think it's going to bring a lot of awareness, you know, to the importance of wetlands and, you know, the fact that the people that are developing, you know, some of these economic developments, they want to see that it's done right, too, because they don't want problems down the road either.
Senator Wongard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Awesome. You have a wonderful week. Enjoy the holiday. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you, too. That's Senator Van Wongard, who represents the 21st State Senate District. That includes parts of Racine and Kenosha counties. We talked to him earlier today about a bill that aims to improve wetlands health in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, in response to concerns about the possibility of new gun laws, Florence County in northern Wisconsin declared itself as a Second Amendment sanctuary. We'll look at the ways local governments are responding to state and federal gun regulations around the country. First, the U.S. Air Force is working on its final environmental impact statement for a plan that could bring F-35 fighter jets to Truax Field in Madison. Madison is one of the preferred communities in the Air Force planning process for those jets. Parts of the Madison community have voiced concerns about noise and pollution. Recently, we talked to Democratic State Representative Chris Taylor about why she doesn't support the plan. Today, we'll hear a different perspective. Chris Arnes is the executive director of the Badger Air Community Council, a group that supports bringing F-35s to Truax. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, from your perspective, why should they station those F-35s in Madison?
Well, really what the F-35 coming to Madison means is the longevity of the 115th Fighter Wing. So absent a new mission, the current F-16s will time out. So I am a retired F-16 pilot here at the 115th Fighter Wing, and I can tell you firsthand that those 32-year-old airplanes are reaching the end of their lifespan. So unless we get a replacement aircraft, we will lose a flying mission in Madison, and then the base will go away.
Can you talk about the economic impact of having that base and the fear of the economic impact of losing that base?
Absolutely. So the base adds $100 million in annual economic impact, including 1,200 jobs. So not only does it add those jobs and that economic impact, but if you think of absent the base, that's 1,200 family members that would be displaced without a job having to go somewhere else if they want to continue to serve their country.
As we mentioned, we talked to Democratic State Representative Chris Taylor about this recently on our show. Here's a bit of what she had to say about the noise concerns in the community.
These jets are not just a little louder than F-16s. The Air Force has estimated that they're between 2 and 4 times louder in different venues. So this is very, very serious for our community.
And that's been one of the big concerns from people who object to this plan, that there will be more of a noise concern than with the F-35s than with the current F-16s.
Well, I will say I know firsthand that that is just not true. I have witnessed an F-35 takeoff next to an F-16 takeoff. And there is a difference in sound, that being the F-16 is a higher pitch noise, with the F-35 being kind of a lower tonal. But I will tell you that if you closed your eyes, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference from a loudness perspective at all.
And one concern that people have raised is they say, and this is getting technical here, beyond my pay grade a little bit, but the idea that the F-35s will be using afterburners more in their takeoffs and landings, I think, than the F-16s. What's that about?
Yeah, I think that the argument is the opposite. So as the environmental impact statement says, that the F-35 is planned to use the afterburner only 5% of the time, where the F-16 uses afterburner 90% of the time. So an F-16 and afterburner is absolutely louder than an F-13 or a F-35 in normal military power.
Talking about an Air Force plan that could bring F-35 fighter jets to an airfield in Madison, Chris Arns is with us with the Badger Air Community Council. He's making the case for that change. Talk a little bit about the status now. This is not a done deal from the Air Force. They're considering other sites around the country.
Absolutely. There are considering five different sites. Madison and Montgomery, Alabama were listed as the top two sites, but the draft environmental impact statement has been released and a comment period has been closed on that. We expect the final environmental impact statement to come out in February with a final decision in March.
I want to listen to one more bit of our conversation with Representative Chris Taylor. Talk about who's impacted by these siting decisions.
In general, I think you can read the information that we have, including the disparate impact that the noise is going to have on communities of color in Madison, low-income individuals, and particularly children who really suffer adverse health impacts from being exposed to this kind of noise.
So concerns over particular communities already disadvantaged, in some cases, communities affected by this decision.
Well, I think where a lot of that comes from is the communities that are around the airport. And that's an inherent issue with the living near the airport. What we are saying is that the impacts that is laid out in the environmental impact study is overstated. And in fact, right in there, it talks about the maximum potential impact. So what we see in practice, once the aircraft arrive, will be much less, and it will be very similar to the F-16s here today.
And a wider concern, people say F-16 or F-35, should we have these military jets in an urban center to begin with?
Yeah, the Air National Guard, by definition, is in urban centers as opposed to the active duty Air Force. We've had been a great community partner. The 115th Fighter Wing has been in Madison for 71 years, and it has never been an issue. And these are community members that are living alongside everyone else. So I think it's actually a very positive benefit and a great thing to have them here.
We've heard from Jesse in Madison, who says Jesse's a realtor, concerned with how this is going to affect property values. And I know for a lot of people raising concerns that they're thinking whatever the actual impacts are, it's going to look bad when you're trying to sell a house in that area.
You know, we contend that there will be no change in sound impact around the area. So those same areas or those same houses should maintain their current value as they go forward.
And people have pointed toward studies from Madison, from the Air Force, both sides point to different studies when they look at the sound impact. I'll say, is it really as unambiguous as you say that they're not going to be substantially louder?
It is. So when we look at, the technical details of the math that goes into the sound contours that are in the environmental impact statement, that is primarily driven by the number of operations, and those operations are absolutely overstated. I can speak from personal experience that it really assumes that all flights are going to fly out of Truax Field in Madison, and that's not the case now, and it won't be in the case in the future. A lot of opponents are also citing environmental impact statements from other bases, which are not an apples-to-apples comparison, so those really shouldn't even be considered.
Is there sound mitigation available for people living near an air base, a National Guard air base in this case, with these fighter jets?
Absolutely. So after the final environmental impact statement comes out and a decision is made, then the process, it's a Part 150 grant that comes from the Federal Aviation Administration. And then those areas can apply for those grants to help, such as insulation in their house. Then there's also a whole operational mitigation that the fighter wing takes part in to change their flight path. One thing that I just want to say overall is what we're really talking about here is not a constant noise that's continuing. They fly twice a day four times a week for about a 6-minute window. So it's, you know, 6 minutes a day, 4 days a week, and that's it. So this isn't this pervasive sound that's going to be constantly going on. It's very isolated into these short windows.
Now, while there are some lawmakers who object, the plan has gotten a lot of support from lawmakers at the state and federal level, some on both sides of the aisle. Do you think that strengthens Madison's case with the U.S. Air Force?
You know, I think it does. I think the Air Force has the comment period and is taking community input very seriously on both sides of the coin. So I think this will all play into their ultimate decision.
A decision from the Air Force, again, expected early next year. What are you watching for as we learn more about what decision is going to be made?
You know, I think as we get closer to that decision point, it just having the community come together, both for and the opponents, and really talk about solutions and how we can mitigate that noise should we be selected.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Chris Arnes, Executive Director of the Badger Air Community Council. He was with us today to talk about why he supports a plan to put F-35 fighter jets at Truex Field in Madison. Last week, we heard from State Representative Chris Taylor, a Democrat who's opposed to that plan. The public comment period for the plan is now closed. The Air Force expects to have a final decision by February or March of next year. Coming up, Florence County is the first in Wisconsin to declare itself a Second Amendment sanctuary. We'll hear from an elected official there and then take a wider look at the ways local governments are responding to gun laws. And by the way, the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue this week. You can hear live coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's NPR News and Classical Music Network. That's the other one, or online at WPR.org. It starts tomorrow at 8. We will also talk about what comes out of today's and tomorrow's testimony here on Central Time in our weekly roundup of national news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes comedian Hari Kondabolu as his tour comes to Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Florence County in Wisconsin is the state's first county to declare itself a Second Amendment sanctuary. At a hearing last week, the vote was unanimous after hearing overwhelming public support for the measure. Florence County is in far northeastern Wisconsin on the Michigan border. Edwin Kelly is the vice chair of the Florence County Board and represents District 8. We spoke with him earlier today about the move and asked how it came about.
It came really from the public finalized, but in the beginning where it came is that people, at least I know I have been, a little bit always wondering about that red glove thing or whatever it is that the governor wants to propose. That could sit there and have the wrong people could get a hold of it, and that wouldn't be very good for anybody that happened to has a weapon or anything in their homes for protection or hunting or otherwise.
And what did you hear from members of the public when you had a hearing about this in front of the county board?
They're the ones that really brought it up. You see, there I'm on the county board, as you know,
right.
And I also am on the legislative committee, and I hold. That's for things that anything that may pertain to Wisconsin or Florence County, probably in particular, come before us that are being negotiated down in Madison or Washington. We sit there and discuss at that meeting. And that's a group of people showed up there at our last legislative meeting before the county board. And they come in and they had this resolution broke up, wrote out. I don't know if you've seen the resolution or not. But anyway, we looked at it, and we as a committee, and I recommend to them, let's bring it to the county board. A couple were saying, ooh, be careful, this is going to stir a mess up all over the country. Well, well, not the country, but the state, they figured. Now I hear that it has went as far as the country. Nope, I says, we bring it up. And I brought it up, and I had them put it on the agenda. And went to unanimously there, and we had a full courtroom in where we hold our meetings. I said, oh, I was thinking to myself, ooh, now what? Nope, they were all for it. The whole bunch, they're all there speaking out for it. No one on the opposite side.
Does this change anything as far as what police officers or with the county sheriff's department, I should say, do right now? Or is this kind of symbolic at this point?
Right now, the sheriff has no problems with anything. He spoke up at the meeting there in favor of what we were proposing. That's all I know. I can't go any further on what he might say.
Gotcha.
And I'm on the legislative committee.
And for the governor and state lawmakers, what do you hope they take out of this decision to pass this in Florence County?
I hope they sit there and keep it in mind when they sit there and go over and start seeing what they have to come up with that red glove thing, which could be a disaster. Maybe not now. It might sound good. What's it going to lead to? Is it going to lead to, as some states or some people in the country have been trying to do, is opening the Constitution and looking at the Second Amendment? Is this going to have an effect that way, a push toward it, depending on whoever gets elected in Washington? I am very nervous about it. With me, it probably wouldn't make any difference. Down the road, it could. And what it's going to be there, and they figure that they're going to sit there and be able to stop and get the weapons all picked up from the people that shouldn't have it. You may be able to do something with maybe that's for people that are mentally needed, but their rules and regulations are there already. But for the criminal element, you think you're going to do anything on it? They're not going to get none of their guns. And they say, well, maybe we got Australia and in England. Look at them. You can't even use them to compare. Because you compare those countries, and then you compare it to the United States. No resemblance.
That was Edwin Kelly, vice chair of the Florence County Board. With this recent move by Florence County, we wanted to take a look at the concept of Second Amendment sanctuaries, how common they are, what usually inspires their creation, and what, if anything, they mean in a legal sense. Adam Winkler is professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
We have this Second Amendment Sanctuary Declaration in Florence County, Wisconsin. Is this something that's happening elsewhere around the country?
It is. It's happening all over the country. There's been both states, about four or five states, and a number of cities, maybe a couple score cities across the country and counties that have passed Second Amendment sanctuary laws or resolutions.
What is motivating local and, in some cases, as you say, state governments to do this?
Well, this is being driven largely by the reinvigoration of the gun control movement in America. You know, up until the Newtown shooting, the gun control movement was really moribund. And that incident, while it hasn't triggered any new federal laws being passed, it has led to a reinvigorated gun safety reform movement. And this is in part a response by those who don't want to see any more gun control laws passed. And it's a symbolic effort, mostly, with very little impact on the ground.
Right. These are sanctuary declarations. Do they have any legal standing? Do they actually change how laws are enforced?
Well, they have legal standing, but they don't make a big difference on the ground. The idea of a sanctuary comes out of the immigration context, where some cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco have declared themselves sanctuary cities that won't enforce federal immigration laws. The Supreme Court has said that that state officers do not have to follow federal mandates, that if the federal government wants to enforce its laws, it can send out its own FBI agents or whatnot to enforce those laws, but you can't conscript state law enforcement officers against their will. And so this is transferred over to the Second Amendment context where local law enforcement officers are saying, we won't enforce gun laws that we don't support, that we think violate the Second Amendment.
Has this in any case led to non-enforcement of already existing federal gun laws, I guess federal background checks, for example?
Well, you know, we haven't seen that on the ground yet, but that is one of the big threats. One of the laws that some states have objected to are federal background checks. For instance, in Wyoming, they passed what they called the Firearms Freedom Act, and it said that that the state government will not participate in conducting federal background checks. Of course, most gun dealers are federally licensed dealers. They have a license from the federal government entitling them to deal firearms. And so those dealers still are conducting background checks because whatever the state law enforcement says they want to do, those dealers have to listen to the federal government. They have a federal license.
Let's talk about some of the laws that the people up in Florence County, including Edwin Kelly, who we heard from, were concerned about. He mentioned, referred to what's called the red flag law that would allow, in certain specific circumstances, a request to be made to a judge to have firearms confiscated for someone who is perceived as being at risk of committing some acts of violence. Is this, there's been some polling support for this. Some states have passed this. Is this something that's been controversial, though, as it's been introduced around the country?
Yeah, these red flag laws have been somewhat controversial, although less controversial than many other kinds of gun reforms. What makes them controversial is that these laws entitle a family member, for instance, or a law enforcement officer to go to a judge and say, hey, look, we've had some interaction with this person. We think this person has firearms and is dangerous right now, immediately, because of some condition or some situation, and we'd like to temporarily take those guns away. And then after a month, those guns have to be returned unless there's a full hearing where the defendant participates and says, well, here's my evidence and whatnot. In general, so what makes them controversial is the idea that you can take someone's guns away, even on a temporary basis. But surprisingly, they really aren't the motivation for most of these sanctuary city laws. It did seem like the councilman did seem to suggest that that was what was motivating him, although I could have sworn he said that these were called red glove laws, but I haven't heard of that before.
I think he's referring to the red flag laws from his description.
I think so. Right. But interestingly enough, red flag laws are an area where there's been growing and emerging bipartisan consensus. And in fact, Lindsey Graham has proposed a federal law that would provide financing for states to enact and enforce red flag laws. So it's surprising that this would be the source of these sanctuary provisions.
Right. We had a very brief special session of the legislature called by Governor Evers here in the state, proposing two pieces of legislation, a red flag law, and then expanding background checks to include most, but not all, private transfers of firearms, private sales in particular. Those were the two things that happened here in Wisconsin, proposed and then quickly rejected by the legislature. Are there other types of laws that have been more likely to provoke these kind of Second Amendment sanctuary statements?
Well, we've seen it in rejecting pushback on universal background checks. There's been some discussion that with some Democratic presidential candidates talking about mandatory gun buyback programs for military-style assault rifles, that maybe one of these laws would be appropriate to stop those laws from going into effect. But the truth of the matter is these laws are not being driven by brand-new gun control laws being enacted, by and large, because by and large, we're not getting a lot of new gun control laws enacted in these states where these laws are taking place. I think it's really about the politics of symbolism, that this is a way for lawmakers to take a stand in favor of the Second Amendment when, truth be told, they've already loosened up the gun laws about as much as they can be loosened.
We're talking about the growing number of Second Amendment sanctuary communities, including Florence County here in Wisconsin. Adam Winkler is with us. He's a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law and the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea, mostly symbolic, as we heard from our guest earlier, of declaring communities as Second Amendment sanctuaries, suggesting that they wouldn't have to cooperate with particular new gun regulations? Would you like to see that happen in your community? Are you in Florence County yourself? What did you think of this idea? Is this something you'd want to replicate somewhere else? Do you have concerns or questions about the possibility of new gun laws here in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about Second Amendment sanctuaries. Florence County just became the first one in Wisconsin that we're aware of anyway. Adam Winkler is our guest, professor of law at the UCLA School of Law and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Florence County passed this resolution last week, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of communities, maybe a city, a township, a county, a whole state, declaring itself as a Second Amendment sanctuary? Would you like to see it happen where you live? If it's not a move you support, what would your reaction be if your city or town took that step? And do you have thoughts about efforts at new gun regulations here in Wisconsin, the very short-lived special session of the legislature to consider expanding gun background checks and to create red flag laws here in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Adam, I wanted to talk to you about some of the politics behind this. You mentioned that the gun control movement was mostly defunct for a long time, not a very politically powerful or active movement. What do you see happening now in 2019?
Well, I think what we see in 2019 is a very invigorated gun control movement. The NRA is struggling a little bit with some internal dynamics and some internal organizational problems they've been having. And we've seen just a tremendous amount of money coming into the gun control movement to finance candidates and to support candidates. It's really telling that the presidential candidates for the Democratic nomination have all come out in favor of very strong and aggressive gun safety reform proposals. In contrast to, say, 2008, when President Obama ran for president and really didn't have any significant gun proposals that he ran on.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Hank is with us in Price County. Hank, hi.
Hi, yeah, good afternoon. This is a great topic, really timely. I'm troubled by the fact that Florence County supervisors or committee members couldn't even get the name of the law correct. I go along with your other guest, the professor, that talks about this being politicized and people not understanding what this law is meant to do. Nobody's taking your guns. This is a public safety issue. If there's anything that county boards need to be involved in, it's public safety. And this flies in the face of public safety.
Hank, thanks a lot for the call. Hank saying, it's more the perception from critics of these laws than the reality of some of the gun control changes. What do you think, Adam?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I was struck by the fact that the commissioner didn't seem to know the name of the law either. He got it wrong several times, and when asked to describe what it did, he didn't seem to really have a great sense of what it did. And I think that's not surprising in one sense. It's not surprising in the sense that I think that when it comes to issues of the Second Amendment, people are really driven by that symbolism and by the idea that, hey, I'm protecting my Second Amendment rights no matter what. Even if what we're really talking about is a red flag law that's only going to very temporarily take guns away from people that a judge has determined is a danger and shouldn't have access to those firearms.
Thanks a lot for the call, Hank. Is part of this that at least some people define in part their identity in relation to the Second Amendment and firearms?
Yeah, I do think there is something about that. I mean, I think that people, really do. The Second Amendment has become very, very meaningful. It's very tied up with people's identity. Even though, gun safety reform advocates have been proposing ever more aggressive gun control laws, and some of which may indeed violate the Second Amendment, such as a mandatory buyback program, by and large, the kinds of laws that we're talking about are laws that are consistently upheld by the courts. No court has struck down a red flag law for saying it violates the Second Amendment. No court has or will strike down universal background checks as being unconstitutional. So when they say these are Second Amendment sanctuary laws, they're sanctuary laws for a vision of the Second Amendment that really has nothing to do with how the Second Amendment has been interpreted by the courts of law in this country.
Hank, thanks for the call. We're talking to Adam Winkler, author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, looking at sanctuary communities, Second Amendment sanctuary communities from local governments around the country, including now Florence County here in Wisconsin. Back to your calls now. Andrew is with us in Madison. Andrew, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question for the expert here. With rules pertaining to, gun control, instead of maybe going after necessarily the assault rifle bans and things like that, has there ever been anything put in place as to minimizing the accessibility to things like high caliber magazines, like 30 caliber magazines and things like that? Or I know that some states have silencers and things like that that are illegal. I guess that's kind of where my question is, where instead of going directly for the right to bear arms, kind of goes directly at what the capacity or the damage that, may an assault rifle could do.
Andrew, thanks for the call. So, Adam, regulating particular types of ammunition or high-capacity magazines that can allow someone to fire a lot without reloading.
Well, I think this has actually been a big push in the gun safety reform movement in states that are sort of more open-minded to gun control than other states. So we've seen in places like California outlawing certain caliber of bullets that are thought to be very highly dangerous and very unusually destructive. We've seen California, for instance, ban high-capacity magazines. You're not allowed to possess a large-capacity magazine in the state of California. These laws are part of the new sort of push in the gun control movement. They're often very, very difficult to enforce. California bans high-capacity magazines, but there's millions of them in the state of California, and there's no evidence that anyone's really turned them in. So sometimes when you regulate some of these things like high-capacity magazines, you're also engaging in a kind of symbolic politics, putting a law on the books that makes it illegal but doesn't actually change the law on the ground.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Mike joins us now in Ladysmith. Mike, hi.
Hi, I'm a gun rights advocate. I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe, I have a black rifle that's cosmetically dangerous, I guess. But what I don't get about this, this idea of a firearm sanctuary, is what are they envisioning are going to happen? Is that as soon as somebody is adjudicated to be, crazy or depressive or whatever the category might be, such that they're going to be dangerous with a weapon, Florence County wants to have those people move to Florence County and be protected in that fashion? I mean, what's the end game here? I don't get it, because I, quite frankly, if I find out that there's a bunch of people that are crazy or they are convicted felons and are planning crimes or whatever the case may be, if I was living in Florence County, do I want to have those people move into my county just so that they can stand protected in some fashion?
Mike, thanks for the call. Adam?
Well, I can't speak for the commissioners, but I guess what they might say is that, well, the problem is with these red flag laws, for instance, is that they might be enforced against someone who isn't really a danger, who isn't really someone who has been adjudicated to be mentally ill or a felony conviction, and thus it's subject to abuse. And I think that's a reasonable claim, that these laws can be subject to abuse. They have safeguards built within them to satisfy the demands of the Constitution for due process of law. It has to be, you can't just take someone's guns away. A judge judge has to determine, a neutral third party has to determine that the person is dangerous under the terms of the statute. But nonetheless, I think any time you take someone's rights away in America, it's going to be a little controversial.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today. The conversation continues.
Thanks again, Rob, for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He joins to talk about the concept of Second Amendment sanctuaries. Also heard from Edwin Kelly from the Florence County Board a little earlier in the conversation. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out a state Supreme Court ruling that says once a minor is tried as an adult, they'll be treated as an adult in future court appearances. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests fire up The Jukebox for a look at the songs and bands that are popular at bars, clubs, and anywhere else you can hear a song for a little bit of spare change, or digital change these days. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the newest inductees to the National Toy Hall of Fame, and we want to hear from you about your favorite toys and games, past or present. You can share yours right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.